And we're off.
One other announcement. I know it's been in the bulletin for a bit, but there are 2 weeks left to sign up for the Tigers game and program going on before that. So far, it's Jared and me going, which will be fun, even if it's that, but it'll also be fun to have a group. So that sign-up is back on the board downstairs. Let me know if you need any information. This week, I spent some time with Psalm 34. We'll have, at the end, another Psalm rewrite, like I did for Psalm 19. Before we get to that, I want to talk some about some cool things that I found in this psalm and the way that it works. Now sometimes we just look at, oh, it's poetry, lots and lots of poetry. But some of them do some kind of unique things. And the more I got into Psalm 34, the more I was able to appreciate what it's doing. So let me share a few things that went into the way that I ended up re-rendering this, and maybe help you appreciate what's going on here as well. First of all, this psalm is an acrostic. Works a little bit differently than the acrostics you might have done in elementary school. We have, in English poetry, the idea of acrostics, but here's what ours usually look like, right? You take a word that you like, you put a letter with it. Here's cats, which are cuddly, acrobatic, tenacious, and softly purring. Right? We've written these kinds of acrostics. Right? You get a few grades up, and they teach you, well, there's more you can do, and so we get like this, but that's probably not very visible, is it? Somebody wrote an acrostic poem, you know, with a thought going through about the word acrostic. It says, an acrostic poem creatively relates the letters of a word and spells a message about the topic in a captivating way. A little more advanced than cuddly cats. And then you can get real fancy and work with the letters within the words. I don't know if this is fancy or if this is cheating. I've never really been able to tell if you use of you're shifting the start. So somebody took Matthew 6:9 and says, pray like this, our Father who is in heaven, may your name be kept holy. It says, look, love, right in the middle. That's kind of what we think of with acrostics. That's not exactly what Hebrew writers do with acrostics. Here's what a Hebrew acrostic looks like. Here is the text of I think this is going to help. This is the text of the first few verses of Psalm 34. And what you can see here is this does not spell a word down the side. Instead, each verse starts with a consecutive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So, Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, that's their ABCD. And as it moves through, every line begins with the next letter. Sometimes they really go crazy with this. If we'll be a little bit until we get to Psalm 119, and that one it has 8 verses for each letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So that's how you end up with 176 verses. Some thoughts is that doing this form of acrostic might have had the idea of helping with memorization. So if you know your alphabet, you've got a head start on remembering the psalm. Another suggestion is that this type of poetry might be intended to get the idea across of this is something that is being presented as a full subject. Like we might say, this is a song to the Lord from A to Z, right? Alpha to Omega. From the beginning of the alphabet to the end. So that's another thought of what might be the reason for doing this. I don't know if knowing this helps us understand the psalm itself all that much more, except knowing that this was done, and trying to do my own English acrostic in this way when I wrote the psalm out, made me appreciate a little bit extra thought that goes into writing these. That you have to slow down a little bit more to make what you're wanting to say go along with that form. So, I find it interesting. Maybe you find it interesting. Maybe you don't. Let's move on to the next one anyway. Another thing about Psalm 34, this has what we call a composite form. If you get into studies of Psalms, you need to be ready for lots of ways of classifying Psalms come up with by very old German scholars. And this one is particularly a guy named Hermann Gunkel. It's a fun name. Gunkel, he said, if you're going to study the Psalms, you need to know the form of the psalm. And he classified all these forms. And he says, here are the standard forms of the Psalms. And you look up, he's got lists where he breaks down, here's where each psalm fits in. And he says, there are different types of psalms. And you need to know if you're reading a hymn. You need to know if you're reading an enthronement psalm where we place God as the king. You need to know if you're looking at a complaint or a lament, which come in the varieties of communal for the community or an individual. Same thing with thanksgiving psalms, royal psalms. You need to know if you're looking at a wisdom psalm, pilgrimage or liturgy. You know, is this something to be done in the temple? I think there's some wisdom to this. In my the main college class that I teach, do a similar thing with the overall shape of the Bible. We say let's look at the different genres that are found in here, because we know we read different genres in different ways. The comparison I'd like to make is you pick up a newspaper, if anybody picks up a newspaper anymore. Pick up a newspaper and you understand that you read different sections of the newspaper in different ways. You understand you're not going to read the front page the same way you do the classifieds, or the same way that you read the comics. We understand there are different expectations for different genres of literature. And so in my class I say, well, we look at those same expectations for different genres in the Bible. Herr Gunkel says we're going to do the same thing with different types of psalms. We've talked about how the broad span of emotions and situations and events behind the psalms, well, it makes sense that we want to know what type they're doing in order to better understand it. But some psalms don't like to fit into categories. And Psalm 34 is one of them. My formatting changed. Those numbers were right next to the word psalm. There is perfect. Anyway, I think you'll be able to stay with me here. The first part of Psalm 34 is an individual thanksgiving psalm, talking about how God has delivered the psalmist from their situation. It says things like, I sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all of my fears. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. This poor man called, and the Lord heard him, saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. This is thanksgiving. This is what we do at Thanksgiving time, where we say, what do you have to be thankful for? And somebody says, what God has done for me. When I look at my life and I look at where I was and how I've been brought to now, I am thankful to the Lord for that deliverance. And then it shifts gears. The rest of the psalm doesn't read that way. It reads more like the wisdom psalms. When we looked at Psalm 19, that was a wisdom psalm as well. It's kind of like what a book like Proverbs is doing, about teaching about who God is, teaching about the way that we act as God's people, and putting it in the poetic form. And that's what verses 11 to 22 have to say. 11 starts with, "Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many good days, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking lies." You see kind of a shift. We're no longer talking about, here's what God has done for me. It's a shift to talking to the audience about God. And so sometimes these sorts of composite psalms cause problems for people. They say, this must have been two works of poetry merged together by an editor. Maybe. Or maybe there is something about thanksgiving being offered to God. Something about having come from a place where God has brought you out of a dark place that leads you to want to teach somebody about God. Maybe we don't have to say this is some sort of merge, but this is somebody who is allowing their situation to flow out to others to try to maybe reach somebody in their situation. Or maybe it's two poems put together. But whatever we have, I think there's value in recognizing that this is not just doing one thing as a psalm. It's got two goals. All right, so we have an acrostic. We have a composite psalm. Finally, let's talk about superscripts. All right. You may have noticed at times, when you open up your Bible to the Psalms, several of them, in between the psalm number, chapter number, and verse 1, you have additional writing. We call these superscripts, a really clever word that means written above, because written above verse 1. And we don't know exactly when the superscripts got added in. We're fairly confident that they weren't in the original Psalms. They're added sometime along the way to give extra information about the situation of the Psalm. Sometimes these are simply notes of authorship. That's the most often one, the most often type. For instance, looking down here, Psalm 35 says, "Of David." That's the most common superscript, "of David," or "of the sons of Asaph." Or so sometimes it's just telling some authorship. Sometimes it gives musical notation. It'll tell you something about how this psalm, as a song written either for public worship or private, how it gets used. So sometimes it'll say, "for the director of music." Sometimes it'll say things like, "this is a maskil," which we have no idea what that means. We think it's some sort of musical note, because it seems to be telling what type of a song it is. Sometimes it says what the tune of the psalm is supposed to be sung to. Yeah, I didn't write down an example of that. I should have. But I'll say, for the director of music, a masculine of David, to the tune of, I forget the number, it says, to the tune of Do Not Destroy. Of course, we don't know that tune, but, you know, at the time, I knew. And it's information that would help in a worship setting, perhaps. And then the other type of superscript would be historical setting. These would be notations that would say, this is what was going on at the time in the author's life. Most famous of that is in Psalm 51, which says this was written after Nathan had spoken to David about his sin with Bathsheba. And that psalm talks about confessing one's sin. Another says it was written when David was hiding from his son Absalom. Psalm 34 has one of these historical superscripts. It says, of David, when he pretended to be insane before Abimelech, who drove him away, and he left. Now, this psalm and this superscript drives a lot of scholars crazy because it doesn't seem to fit. There's a couple things about this. For one, there's nothing in this psalm that seems like pretending to be crazy and tricking somebody into leaving you alone. I wonder what that psalm would sound like. But this is one that doesn't seem to line up real well. And the other thing that bothers some people is here is the narrative that is being referred to here. David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the door of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, "Look at the man, he is insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?" Kind of a funny scene, but somebody reading the superscript to Psalm 34 would go, didn't it say Abimelech here? It says Achish here. And some say that's a problem. It's probably not a problem. The Abimelech seems to be more like a title than a name. I know you probably remember a few Abimelechs showing up. Abraham, the one of the times that he does the tell her you're my sister thing with his wife is when they're into the country of Abimelech. And, you know, there's that scene of Abimelech takes Sarah and God talks to him. And then a few chapters later in Genesis, Isaac is going through the land of Abimelech and says, you know, tell her you're my sister. That same thing again. Abimelech is a name that means my father is the king. You recognize maybe the A-B from Abraham or Abram and Melech means king. So this probably is like a title, maybe like various rulers of Egypt are all called Pharaoh. That's what's probably going on. So if anybody says, contradiction here? No, probably not. But there's still that issue of, what do I make of this superscript that doesn't seem to match? And that kind of leads to where I wanted to go this morning, if that wasn't enough setup. Here's the problem I have with superscripts. I think when you put, and this is particularly of these historical superscripts, it is so hard when you've been told, look for this before you read something, it's so hard to see anything other than that. At times that I've had students write papers on psalms, I've made the mistake of giving them a psalm with one of these historical superscripts. And I look at the paper and I say, okay, this is not a paper on Psalm 79. This is a paper on 2 Samuel 3. Now, this is not a paper about the words of the psalm. This is about David hiding from Absalom, because those words are at the top, and so that's all we can see. And then when somebody says, read this psalm and tell me what it means to you, well, this means David must have really been in a bad spot. And we have a hard time separating that original suggested situation and allowing it to apply to our own, or allowing it to apply to something today. And that's why sometimes in my classes I've come down a little too hard on superscripts and told them, ignore them. Don't worry about those. Try to think of something new. And that's probably not the best way of presenting it. So I'm going to try something a little different today. I'm not going to talk about you need to ignore superscripts because of the problem with superscripts. Let's talk about the opportunity with superscripts. Starting off with the given that we're pretty certain that they were not original to the text. Which does not mean we dismiss them, but that means that we can recognize there is a history of somebody taking a psalm and saying, I think there's meaning to be found here. That this sounds like this happening in somebody's life. This sounds like something David may have said at this time. This sounds like something that would have been done here. And added value to the text in that way. I think that while Psalm 51 shouldn't only be understood as something David would have prayed at the time, I think having that image there is so helpful, of having somebody pouring out their heart, saying, I have messed up so big, saying, I feel so low and sinful, God, I need you. I think having that superscript on there is a helpful thing. But I think we can go further. I think that when we think about superscripts, we have the opportunity to write new ones. Now don't worry, remember, it's before verse 1, so you're not messing up a verse. In the same way that we can appreciate a psalm better by having that suggestion of here's how it might have worked in David's life, or somebody like that, we can look at a text, and like it says in the corner of the bulletin, it's Chase's corner, but I told you it's your corner this week, we can look at one of these psalms and use that space between the number and verse 1 and put in a new face. We can put in a face from somebody today. We can say, this looks like something that would have been written by, prayed by, sung by somebody I know. So the title this morning was, This is the Life. Well, that's the idea that I'm suggesting with the superscripts. You can say, this is the life of fill in the blank. It doesn't have to be David or Solomon or somebody. We have to imagine their life from millennia ago. We can say these words, these are still living, inspired words from God that can tell somebody's story today. I think this can go in one of two ways. We could use superscripts to use a psalm like a mirror. Sometimes we look at the words and say, this looks like my life, and I find myself in these words, and we can have a new appreciation and a new life for the text by saying, I've been there. and I've said those words. Maybe I didn't have the words for it then, and now I can express it. The other way is we can see this as a window into somebody else's life. Pause here, and just I want to make a note that as I was trying to find pictures for this, you have no idea how hard it is to find a picture of looking in a window that is not incredibly creepy. I went through pages and pages of looking in a window. Like, I almost changed this part of the sermon to have a different image because you think about it, that is kind of creepy. Look, kids looking in a window. Okay, got this. That works. All right. So let's try not to think of creepy looking in a window at somebody's life. But by utilizing this idea of superscripts, we can try to understand somebody better. You say, I haven't been through this, but I know somebody that this sounds like. And we read those words through that, maybe lens is better than window. And we can say, this sounds like the prayer of fill in the blank. And maybe you can appreciate that person's situation better. And maybe that can give you the empathy to speak with someone. I think it's better when we are able to understand one another's burdens better. And so that's why I think that there is the opportunity when it comes to superscripts. It is a strange thing that we don't know exactly where it came from, but I think it gives us that freedom to find a new way to understand these texts. And so as I was going through Psalm 34 to rewrite this psalm, to try to bring it to some situation today, I decided to set aside David and Abimelech and the crazy drooling man writing on the door frames. Because I don't know what to do with that. But as I see this psalm of somebody that says, praise God for what he's done for me, and let me tell you something about this God. And I look at these words about calling on God in the troubles, I created a new superscript. This is the one that I thought of. You may see somebody different. And maybe that's the point. I see this as someone who has been relieved from a life of deep depression and brokenness, and who has something to share with someone else. It's not my story, but I really enjoyed or appreciated spending the time in those shoes this week as I was going through this psalm. And so here is my acrostic composite. Superscripted Psalm 34 that I hope can find some meaning in the listening here. So, no longer alone, a psalm of renewed joy. Ask me why I sing. The answer is my God. Because of my God, my soul rejoices. The broken and burdened sing his praises. Come sing a verse with me. Call upon his name with the chorus of the redeemed. Do you remember where I was before he rescued me? Drowning in fear, without and within, until he delivered me. Everyone he touches knows the joy I now feel. Each tear wiped away, every nagging doubt evaporated. For how can I feel alone when I know he hears me? When I fell into darkness, he found me and cared for me, guiding the lost one home. God's angels stand guard over and around. How good is our God! His hand is a shelter in the midst of heartache. I fear no man, nor any indignity this world offers. Judgment for the wicked and the just belongs to Jehovah. Kings fall and even warriors waste away. Keep near the Lord, and he will not forsake you. Listen to me now and learn from my story. The Lord is like a lion, untamable, uncontrollable. May you desire the joy of the Lord as many days as you live. No longer speak evil nor spread lies. Only seek the ways of our God. Pursue his peace. Put away your desires for this world's praise. Quietest of cries reach his ear, and he listens, quelling even the sorrows spoken only by the heart. Rises against the demons that separate us from him, removing them from memory forever. Surely he hears the righteous when they cry out, saving them from their struggles. Troubled and broken hearts are drawn near to him. Those who are crushed in spirit will be saved. Upright men and women will undergo trials until the Lord delivers them from all troubles. Victory over harm is assured, vitality restored to his people. Wicked ones will be slain by their own evil. Extermination awaits the foes of the righteous. Yahweh redeems his servants. Zion stands as a refuge where no believer may be condemned. Had to tweak a few things because we have 26 letters and they had 22. So to shorten a few things. And you have to cheat on X. You just have to. But the words of the psalm are still alive. These words are not limited to one scene at one time in the life of one man. These words still speak to and for believers. And while this is the end of the psalm, I want to end with one more statement with a little bit of nod to the psalm. Strangely, and nobody's got a really good answer for why, when Psalm 34 goes all the way through the alphabet, it adds on one extra letter at the end, an additional, the letters pay, but the letter P in Hebrew. I decided not to do that with this, but we'll close with one more statement, starting the letter P. Praise the Lord for his living word, which speaks to his people throughout the ages. I hope, as we are studying through the Bible this year, as you look at the Psalms in your home study, you know, these are the ones that we aren't doing in a class, I hope that you can find some appreciation for the strange but also significant inspired speech in the Psalms that we are invited to find ourselves and our neighbors in. That's all for this morning. If you need to say, I need to find myself in this story, I need baptism, or I need prayers, or I need to just share something. I have a word that I have to bring forward. Please, we want to hear it. Please do so as we stand and sing.
There's a fountain free, 'tis for you and me.